Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the Education Finance Division to order. Representative Hewitt, I saw that you were reviewing the minutes from the our previous meeting on what day was that? The 6th, February 6th, of course. Are you in a position to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I am, and I move the minutes.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the Hewitt motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Today is an opportunity for us to review or learn about the funding of the number of early childhood programs. As you know, we have an early childhood finance committee chaired by Representative Pinto, but that that committee will its work on the K-12 side will flow through this committee. So we will eventually see it coming forward. So laying a base on the finance questions around early childhood seemed to be important, as well as, of course, the kids in early childhood usually then end up in the schools. And so being able to understand better how they're prepared or how prepared they are seemed to be important to the committee as well. So with that, I'd like to ask Bobby Berman, the Director of Early Learning Services from the Department of Education, and Sandy Myers, the Early Learning Services Supervisor, to please come forward. Ah, okay. Ms. Burnham, it looks like you're flying solo today. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the director of the Division of Early Learning Services at the Department of Education. My colleague and scholarship guru, Sandy Myers, is home ill, as well as being from Hastings. I told her to stay home and not venture out on the road. So you'll have to put up with me going through the scholarship program today. I'll do the best I can. So today I wanted first to give you some context around the work we do at the Department of Education. As a whole, over the last 2 years, we've really worked intentionally as an agency to prioritize equity. And through the work of the leadership team, we are committed to these 10 Minnesota commitments to equity. And you can see as number 6 is starting early. And so these really guide the work we do on a daily basis. In the work that we do in the Division of Early Learning Services, we really view our work across a prenatal through age 8 or grade 3 learning continuum, with a focus on supporting families and community outreach through a really two-gen approach. We focus on parent education and, of course, mental and physical health. You can see through the 0-3 programming that we work cross-state agency to partner in the implementation of home visiting, early intervention, early head start, child care, both public and private. Then we move into that age 3-5 bracket where we implement public pre-K, head start, early childhood special education, child care, and community-based preschools, and into those early elementary years of full-day kindergarten, early elementary grades, and before, after, and summer school programming. So our goal in our division is to really ensure that we provide support and technical assistance around this learning continuum with high-quality early care and education opportunities. We base all of our work on a standards-based approach. Through our Race to the Top grant, we had the opportunity to develop and implement and expand several of our program areas. One of the more important pieces, because it serves as the base of all of our work across the agencies, was the revision of the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress, which is our birth through age 5 set of early learning standards. All programs use these, and these indicators of progress create a coherence for all children and families as they move from program to program. All the programs work with the latest research When we went through this revision process, we engaged the partnership with 120 teachers, directors, researchers, coaches, trainers, and institutes of higher ed. And it's important to remember that these are a continuum of increasingly complex learning standards for children as they enter kindergarten. And just another visual, that the ESIPs really serve as our base for a coherent system, both for the experiences that the children have in areas of professional development, curriculum, assessment, instruction, as well as they serve as the common bond across all program types, whether it be childcare, Head Start, public school, pre-K, or community-based childcare or parent-rated programs. You can see this list is the list of the eight domains: social-emotional approaches to learning, physical and movement development are in addition to the K-3 standards, and we've worked hard to align these ESEPs with the K-3 standards. And again, if you're interested, I'd be happy to get you a copy of the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress. And you can see that they're formatted in a way that really provides a nice continuum of expectations and outcomes along those age ranges. The way the standards are displayed in the core document supports the planning of teachers across age ranges, especially given the unpredictability and of individualized instruction. So setting that context, today I'm going to give you a brief overview of our early Head Start, our Head Start voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus programs, as well as the early learning scholarship program. We're going to start with early Head Start and Head Start. So Head Start, as you know, is a comprehensive early child education program for children from at-risk backgrounds from ages birth to age five. Each Head Start program engages parents as equal partners with their child's teacher and works closely with the local community to adapt to what each community needs are. This map gives you an idea of the range of Head Start programs and where they are located regionally. We have 33 grantees and one grantee that also holds the grant for the migrant seasonal grants. And most of the Head Start grantees are in community action agencies, one school district, and nonprofits. And we have eight tribal programs. As you know, that the state of Minnesota provides, in addition to a federal Head Start allocation, we have a state allocation of $25.1 million. It's allocated equally based on each program's portion of the federal funds and proportion of unmet needs. Migrant and tribal program funds are allocated based only on the program's share of federal funds. And programs are required to complete an annual program plan, and the program plan details how they will serve children with those state funds. Minimum funded state enrollment is determined when the program's federally negotiated cost per child is divided into their portion of the state allocated funds. So a few details on the early Head Start. Of course, the purpose of early Head Start is to promote school readiness of low-income children by enhancing the social and cognitive development through the provision of comprehensive health, education, nutritional, and other services. The age requirement of early Head Start is pregnant mothers or infant and toddlers 2-3 years. Family income is equal to or below the federally poverty line, or they must be participating in MFIP or may be experiencing homelessness or in foster care. Additional selection criteria may include eligible for special education or early intervention services and other relevant risk factors, which could be, for example, opioid or substance abuse in the family, incarcerated parent, military deployment, or parents' level of education. So the total number of early Head Start enrollment with using both state and federal funds is 3,098, and we have a wait list as of October 18 of 2,279. A program must annually establish selection criteria that weigh the prioritization of selection of participants. Children with high needs move to the top based on this established selection criteria. You can see the funding amount both at the federal and the state level. And the key program components of Early Head Start includes education, health, nutrition, mental health, social services. Early Head Start serves pregnant mothers and children to age 3 in home visiting and center-based family child care settings. And program must use an assessment tool to measure ongoing development and child outcomes at regular intervals over the year. So that is our Early Head Start program. Our Head Start program.
Ms. Birnbaum, if you could pause for a moment. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the department, Ms. Burnham, collect data other than the percentages I see for exiting Head Start, three-year-olds, 84% met the developmental targets, and four-year-olds at 78%. Does the department collect any other data on Head Start, since we do partially fund it, that would be more specific indicators?
Ms. Birnbaum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are working with our Head Start partners very closely on establishing more data sharing agreements. Right now, Head Start agencies are required to provide data at the federal level, and we use that data. But we work closely and have a great relationship with Gail Kelly and her association, and are working as we speak and have been over the last couple years on more effective ways to share data. And so we have several data sharing agreements with some of the Head Start agencies, but not all. And so part of our grant work in the preschool development grant, as well as a current federal grant, we are working on better data sharing between the agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We look forward to getting that data. Thank you.
Ms. Burnham, these numbers, the three-year-olds exiting the program at 84% meeting developmental targets, four-year-olds meeting 78% of the targets, compare to other early childhood programs, the scholarships, the other programs that we support?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. Unfortunately, we currently do not have a method of collecting child outcome data for the scholarship program. We do have an impact measure for the voluntary pre-K program, which I will go over in my voluntary pre-K slides. But in right now, MDE does not have the authority to collect statewide data that would give us the same type of data that you're seeing here from Head Start.
Thank you. Representative Nornes, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, a brief one, I guess. Just trying to remember back, I think, to probably Governor Carlson. Before that, has the state always provided money for Head Start? Has that always been a part of the program? Or it seems to me that that started under his leadership, and I'm not positive of that.
Ms. Burnham, how's your history this morning?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me look. I've got a chart here. I have data back to 2005 that shows us just over $17 million at that time, and it's now at 25.1.
And, Ms. Burnham, my recollection is that not all states match federal funds for Head Start. Do you know, we can come back to you. I'm trying to continue the conversation here, Representative Nornes. But how does Minnesota compare to other states on the issue that Representative Nornes raised?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That is a really good question. I don't have that data, and I'm not aware. I know that Minnesota is one of very few, but we can certainly find that out and get back to you.
Okay. Representative Nornes, you have questions from you, sir?
I think that's covered it. That was just, it's not required that the state pay I mean, this is something that we've chosen to do in addition to the federal money. So that's, I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, thank you, sir. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mrs. Burnham. I just want to go back because I think Chair Dabney raised a very good question on the effectiveness of the program. And you mentioned that we don't have access to that data, and I just want to make sure we have the right context. Is that still because that program resides in DHS and there's not a good agreement between the two to share the data, or are there other factors?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, so that's kind of a multi-pronged question. So currently, within the Department of Education, we have what we are now calling the Kindergarten Entry Profile. We only have authority to, it's a voluntary program, it's, and we get less than a 10% sampling each year due to the voluntary nature of that program. So we have, and that data that we do collect is not representative of a statewide sample of kindergarten readiness. As I mentioned, with the voluntary pre-K program, we do require an impact measure, so we are starting to collect some decent data from our voluntary pre-K programs. Regarding the DHS programs, which are you referring to the Head Start, or not the Head Start, the Parent Aware rated programs? They do an evaluation study, but I believe it does not collect child outcome data. So as part of the OLA recommendations, which several of the recommendations mentioned the ability to better share data across agencies and the recommendations to collect certain data from early childhood programs. As you may know, we recently received a federal one-year planning grant whose the main purpose was to do a comprehensive statewide needs assessment and develop a strategic plan. And so within that one-year planning grant, we budgeted money to determine what is needed for better data sharing, what is needed for a universal identifier to collect and know the data that we're getting from each of the agencies. And it's going to involve a very intentional community outreach effort and stakeholder engagement effort. So I believe at the end of this one-year planning grant, we may have some solid direction to take as to what's needed for better data sharing and a universal identifier to collect the data.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And the reason I bring this up, we have all worked on this issue, and this is something very, very important. I know, Mr. Chair, we've talked about the homeless factor and getting this data. In my world of working with child protection, this data is so critical. And one of the things that I would put in front of this committee, and it's, we've said it way in the history, but we're resetting now, knowing this data and being able to look at it in an objective way it permeates all the way through what could be happening, pre-indicators of homelessness, pre-indicators of foster care, all of that stuff. And for whatever reason, and I know why the reasons, and they're not intentional, it's just hard. But getting to that point, and one of the challenges I would make for us in this committee is, let's find a way to share that data. There's MnLink programs, there's other ones, because we can make better decisions. And I know I've worked with colleagues on both sides. We can get to that spot, but we have to lead these agencies because they're not going to be able to do it without our leading on that. So I just want to thank you, Ms. Burnham, for bringing this up, and I just want to make sure we don't gloss over this because this is so critical to what we do every day here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Grisha. I think you're spot on. And the crack staff up here seems to have done the archival. Oh, that wasn't a good phase, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, we'll double-check. There was a separate line item for a few years, so we want to make sure we get you the right first year.
Representative Nornes, they're trying to do the archaeological work to answer your question of the Carlson administration, and, you know, they're down a couple of layers of soil.
We need to know our history.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I probably just haven't had enough coffee this morning, and I kind of caught what Chair Dabney was saying. So we do have some data from Head Start. but we have no data, and is there any plans to get data or formulate a way we can get data from the scholarship program so we can actually see if those are working as well?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. So an important note to make is that the scholarship is a funding. It's a funding mechanism. It's not a program. So to receive a scholarship, you have to attend a parent-aware rated program or a school-based program that is also parent-aware. So the question becomes, how are we collecting multiple data points from those rated programs who serve scholarship children? So that would be able to give us data on multiple data points, including child outcome, program data, community data. So that's just one way of collecting data for those kids who get scholarships.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the explanation. Like I said, I haven't had enough coffee this morning. So, yeah, it would be a lot more multiple data points, but very enriching data, I think, if we could figure out a way to collect that since we are also spending money there.
Absolutely.
Punch over to Representative Kreisha again. We seem to have found a theme here.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is very important. And to Chair Joachim, I want to point this out to clarify the record, too. We are supposed to have this data. If you go back to Minnesota Statutes 124D.165, the commissioner was directed, and I'll read right from here, report required, subdivision 5, the commissioner shall contract with an independent contractor to evaluate the early learning scholarship program. The evaluation must include recommendations regarding the appropriate scholarship amount, and you can read the rest. But we have a new commissioner, and I would ask, let's make them accountable. MDE is supposed to be doing this. This data we're asking for is not a wish, it is law. So I would just bring that up for our clarification.
Well, and thank you for that, Representative Kreisha. And the scholarships may be a funding mechanism and not a program, but this sort of data and the ability to compare would be a significant indicator on what are we getting for that funding.
Yep.
And if they're punching above these numbers, because these are attractive numbers, great. If they're punching below, that would be a area of concern.
Agreed.
So, Representative Erickson, I believe you had indicated interest to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, you mentioned a kindergarten profile, and I know it's not a part of this presentation, but when you finish, could you describe what that is? I've not heard that before, kindergarten profile, and it must be done during the voluntary pre-kindergarten to go into kindergarten. So if you would share that with us later, thank you.
Ms. Burnham, can you
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to do that.
Thank you. And Representative Nornes, the staff's confidence in 1989 is rising as the first point that the state supplemented federal Head Start funds. So you were right, Carlson administration. Maybe we owe you a donut or something.
I'm just glad my memory still works.
That's Perpich?
89.
Oh, 89. You're right. I was thinking 99. All right. Very good for an English teacher. Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to circle back on the 24D.165, we did do an evaluation of the scholarship program back in 2016, and so I'm sure that would be available. So we did it, and I'd have to look at the statute. I don't have it memorized. As if it directs us to collect individual child outcome data. So,
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just very quickly, I have the pages going to send us get copies of all that for us. If I could make a request, Mr. Chair, maybe you could get that report to all of us as well. And it gives us a little bit more background and context. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if we could please get that report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will be happy to do that.
Please continue.
Okay. So the Head Start program, and it's the Head Start program serves children ages 3 to 5 years old. Family income must be equal to or below the federal poverty line, and participating in MFIP, children experiencing homelessness or in foster care, so same eligibility requirements. for early Head Start. You can see that the total funded Head Start enrollment with both state and federal funds was 10,803, with a wait list of 2,914. And again, those prioritized areas are moved to the top of the list. And you can see the federal funding along with the state funding. And the comprehensive programming for children and families, again, is similar to Early Head Start with the inclusion of education, health, nutrition, mental health, social services. Head Start serves 3 to 5 year olds from low-income families and center-based and home visiting programming. And programs are required to utilize research-based curriculum and assessment tools, which are developmentally appropriate. And they must use this assessment tool to measure ongoing development and child outcomes at regular intervals over the year. And as mentioned, the outcome measure is percentage of children who met developmental targets upon exiting Head Start. In 2016-17, 3-year-olds was 84% and 4-year-olds was 78%. And I do believe that the majority of the Head Start programs do use a state-approved early childhood assessment tool. We also, in Minnesota, have in March of 2015, the Administration of Children and Families at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services awarded 6 early Head Start child care partnerships and early Head Start expansion grants in Minnesota. The program integrates early Head Start comprehensive services and resources into an array of traditional child care and family care settings. Early Head Start child care partnership grantees leverage multiple funding sources to maximize resources and provide quality child care opportunities for children from families with low income. The partners layer funding to provide comprehensive services and high-quality early learning environments for low-income working families with infants and toddlers. And some of the long-term outcomes for the programs include sustained, mutually respectful, and collaborative early Head Start child care partnerships, a more highly educated and fully qualified workforce, an increased supply of high-quality early learning environments and infant-toddler care, a well-aligned early childhood policies, regulations, and resources with quality improvement support at the national, state, and local level, and improve family and child well-being and progress towards school readiness. We are very fortunate, again, like I mentioned earlier, to have a very strong working relationship with our Minnesota Head Start Association. We, at the Minnesota Department of Education, housed the Head Start collaboration director, and she sits at multiple tables. We recognize how important it is to have that Head Start voice at all tables within the work of our division and across agencies. So they have become and will remain a valuable partner. Now we're going to transition into voluntary pre-K and school readiness plus. So first we'll start with voluntary pre-K. The eligibility to participate free of charge in voluntary pre-K is you must be 4 years of age by September 1st. You can see the number of seats allocated. In year one, we had 3,160 seats. And over the last 2 fiscal years, we've added to 3,000 additional seats and then another 1,000 additional seats. And you can see the total breakdown between the number of VPK versus school readiness plus seats there. So in fiscal year 2017, you can see the general fund was awarded at just over $27 million. For those 3,160 seats, and then we had additional money the last 2 years to add those new 4,000 seats. Funding notes, funding for voluntary pre-K is a grade level based on seat counts and is funded at a 0.60 ADM, which is an average daily membership. Students are enrolled and designated as a voluntary pre-kindergarten grade level student in the data system, which we call MARS. This entry generates general education funding as well as all pupil-driven formulas, including compensatory funds. As we get into some of the program components, I wanted to just provide some context that back when we were developing the program standards for voluntary pre-K, we were looking at the definition from the U.S. Department of Ed around their definition of high quality, so we tried to embed as many of those evidence-based qualities into the program standards, which we mostly were able to do. I think most importantly, the voluntary pre-K program is really focused on providing instruction through a play-based learning model to foster children's social and emotional development, cognitive development, and physical and motor development, as well as language and literacy skills, including the native language and language skills of dual language learners. And the content is, of course, aligned with the state early learning standards and kindergarten through grade 3 standards. There is a minimum 350-hour requirement for voluntary pre-K, and you must assess each child's skills when the child enters and again before the child leaves the program using an age-appropriate version of a kindergarten entry profile approved tool. And you must implement strategies that support alignment of professional development, instruction, curriculum, and assessments on that pre-K through grade 3 learning continuum. Other key program components include a 1-to-10 teacher ratio with a maximum class size of 20. Teachers must be knowledgeable in early childhood curriculum and assessment in working with English language learners and must be paid comparably to K-12 teachers. Parents are involved in the program and kindergarten transition activity planning. Program coordinates with relevant community-based services, including health and social services. And they must provide joint professional development activities for school district and those community-based early childhood partners. The voluntary pre-K program does have key evaluation components. Teachers are provided with professional development training and coaching that is informed by a teacher-child observation tool, and the programs must implement and measure the impact of the voluntary pre-K program by using either a self-designed or an MDE-designed model and provide results in their World's Best Workforce annual summary to the Commissioner of Education. So I'll talk a little bit more about that impact measure.
Ms. Burnham, can you pause for a moment? Representative Pryor, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. And it was a different presentation this morning, but we had the same presentation in the early childhood division. And so I get to ask the same questions again. But it was a good review, and now I get to revisit it because it's all such important information. We actually talked about this in the other committee, and I want to go back to it and understand it better now, because we talk about the on the formula it's 0.6 for these programs, but it's 1-to-10 ratio, so it needs a lot of people in the classroom. And they need to be paid comparable. So why is it that it's funded? What's behind it that the funding is 0.6 instead of 1 as other elementary kids would be funded?
Ms. Turner?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a really great question. And I'm not sure of the historical background of why it was 0.60 between that and a full-time student. Do you remember the conversations that took place back a couple of years ago?
Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder, Government Relations at Minnesota Department of Education. When voluntary pre-kindergarten was launched in Minnesota, part of the conversation from school districts was the interest and desire to be able to have multiple programs running at a time. So having 2 half-day programs available in their buildings because of a space concern. So that is more the genesis of the 0.6 ADM being able to meet the desire of school districts to be able to fit the programs into existing buildings.
Representative Pryor?
So then it's saying it's a half day is what they're in, but it still takes more. So instead of just saying 0.5, they're saying it's actually more generous by saying 0.6.
Ms. Snyder?
Depending on the programming provided at the school district, yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Strom, you wanted in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pryor, the hours essentially convert to the 0.6. So in the statute itself, it refers to 510 hours of service compared to the hours of service of kindergarten, which are 850. So it's the ratio of the 510 to the 850 that gives the 0.6. And some districts have a longer program than that, but to reach the 0.6, it's the 510 hours of service. And that's where the 60% on the...
And if I may then also, but the it seems though the ratio, this seems to be, you know, that we need more... To run these programs, when you have a 1-to-10 ratio, it would be more than the K through 6 part of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, yes, the districts could probably tell us a little about their cost structure for those, but I would guess that with the staffing requirements that their costs may be above the average program cost. Okay.
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. expanding on Representative Pryor's question about teachers in the classroom, though the presentation talks about teachers being knowledgeable about curriculum and assessment, is it required that teachers in early childhood education are licensed and certified?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, that is not in statute. So that requirement is not in there.
Representative Sandell.
Under those circumstances, as you talk about teachers being paid equal to K-12 teachers, one of the complaints I heard as I was campaigning, people talking about early childhood education and difficulty to get teachers because the pay was so low. How do you, I guess, justify those two suggestions, that the pay should be equal to K-12 and yet currently pay for early childhood education, early childhood teachers are so low?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, that's a really, really great question. It's important to note that I'll get the percentages to you, but the majority of early childhood teachers are licensed. And so that, even though isn't in the statute, our goal was to promote a comparable pay requirement, although I know we don't define comparable, but the guidance we give to our VPK programs is that it needs to be on the same pay scale as the K-12 teachers, knowing that most of them are licensed.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So 2 years ago, we were given more state money and a new program to implement called School Readiness Plus. And it's got many similar program components and characteristics to voluntary pre-K, and it's got a few that are not in common. You can see that the eligibility is a little bit different. The School Readiness Plus requirement does target certain eligibility or risk factors. Those risk factors include qualifies for free and reduced lunch, is a English language learner, is homeless or is in foster care, has a individual education program or interagency intervention plan, and has a risk factor identified through health and developmental screening. All children's 4 years of age by September 1 are eligible along with those qualified risk factors. You can see the allocated seats there and the funding for fiscal year 18 and 19, those additional 4,000 seats. And again, it is funded similar to VPK at a 0.60 ADM. key instructional and assessment component, again, similar to VPK, includes 350 hours in instruction, and it must provide program and instruction aligned with state guidelines and based in research. Programs must assess each child's skills when the child enters and, again, when the child leaves the program. And the classrooms must ensure appropriate student-child ratio. It doesn't define it. Must provide a licensed teacher, coordinate kindergarten transition planning, involve parents, coordinate with relevant community-based services, and cooperate with adult basic ed and adult literacy services. It has does not have any requirements around evaluation. And so what we've done here, and I don't know if you would like me to go through component by component, but what this does is it lines up the voluntary pre-K components in comparison to the School Readiness Plus. So the next several slides will give you an indication of what's similar between the two programs and what is different. I think to highlight a couple you can see there are many similar teacher qualifications, and compensation is one big difference. School Readiness Plus does require a licensed teacher, but does not have any language around comparable pay. And it also does not require any sort of valuation component. It does state that you must assess upon entry and exit, but it does not state what should be done with that data, or it should be collected by the Department of Ed. So one important note in for the voluntary pre-K is the voluntary pre-K impact measure is a feedback loop between the department and its program. So we are working on building a data structure that when they give us their impact data, we submit a very comprehensive summary report back to them to help inform their policy and practices and instruction.
Ms. Burnham, one moment, please. Representative Katiza-Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, it's good to see you again. I'm hopeful to clarify a little bit about the teacher qualification and compensation portion. What was sort of the idea behind not requiring the same licensing between these two programs? Did School Readiness Plus came first, if I'm correct? No. Okay. So it's a further iteration of the program, and then it was updated.
Ms. Burnham, Mr. you want to walk through memory lane here?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, having a licensed teacher was in our original proposal when voluntary pre-K first was proposed. So it was taken out at some point of approval. And the School Readiness Plus language was not proposed by the department.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Snyder, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, going through sort of the memory lane process of School Readiness Plus, School Readiness Plus was sort of the genesis of a desire for more flexible programming based on the School Readiness Program, which a lot of school districts are very supportive of, while also focusing programming funding on students with a risk factor. So that's sort of where its genesis came from.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Katiza-Watun.
A quick follow-up. Has there been any feedback on whether or not this loosening potentially of licensing requirements makes it easier for programs to facilitate a grow-your-own type program?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, I think that I'm pretty sure I have a slide coming up. You can see with the numbers that many more sites and districts choose to implement the voluntary pre-K program standards than they do the School Readiness Plus standards, because many of them were already implementing programs that reached that level of program standard. And so the thought of implementing yet another new set of standards wasn't very appealing, but some did choose to implement it, and I believe I have, if I don't have a chart in the slide deck, I do and can get that to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Okay, just I think one or two more slides. I'm going to get into a little more detail on the impact measure around voluntary pre-K as we move forward. So, and I think this will get to Representative Erickson's question around the kindergarten entry profile. Part of our Race to the Top work, one of our activities was working on developing a comprehensive P through 3 assessment system. And again, we define that as prenatal through third grade. So many of you may be familiar with a term called the School Readiness Study, which has a very old term that was revised through the work of the Race to the Top. The School Readiness Study took that 10% sampling and produced an annual report on the kindergarten entry assessment. Again, that annual report was not representative of the state kindergarten because it was voluntary and such a small sample size. So through the Race to the Top, we were able to do a really valid and reliable process to revised the School Readiness Study, which is now known as the Kindergarten Entry Profile. So through the Race to the Top, in the first phase of that, we took the 8 most commonly used kindergarten entry assessments and aligned them to the ESIPs, which are the Early Learning Indicators of Progress. From those 8, we determined that 4 tools were more closely aligned to the standards than the other 4. So then we took those 4 tools and aligned them to each other. So when at the end of the day, if one district used TS Gold and the other district used work sampling, we were able to compare apples to apples. So we benchmarked those 4 tools along to get the similar results. And so that was the Race to the Top project with the kindergarten entry profile. So when voluntary pre-K was proposed and funded, we wanted to, knowing that we didn't collect the kind of data we really wanted to from the kindergarten entry assessment, we wanted to take advantage of an opportunity to try to collect a better set of data from this voluntary pre-K program. So that's why we designed the voluntary impact measure. So it not only, but I'm going to come back to this slide. So the voluntary pre-kindergarten impact measure is really based on collecting a set of data elements. It collects child demographic data, it collects individual item level assessment data, and it collects program data, and you can see the different data points. So the development of the impact measure is a collaboration within the division between our early childhood special ed partners and our other program areas to help inform the work that districts are currently doing in World's Best Workforce. The data from the early childhood special ed and scholarship children enrolled in VPK classrooms is included in the impact measure, so we could identify those scholarship children who attend VPK and ECSE programs. We are developing what we're calling a data warehouse to be able to collect these multiple data points and then turn around and produce a report to schools that shows them the program data, the child data, and to help inform their policies and practices. These assessment tools that are part of this profile are all based on authentic assessment. And when I taught kindergarten 30 years ago, you know, it was where you pulled the child out in the hallway and drilled them with flashcards, and so that was not authentic assessment. So now, fortunately, authentic assessment is observation-based. It occurs within the education routine of the day, so it's observation-based, so teachers are constantly observing when children are in centers or whole group instruction or at recess or at FIED or music. It can include work samples, videos, or photos. It's conducted over time, and it incorporates verbal and nonverbal responses. These authentic assessments do not rely on one-to-one assessment. They do not rely on the question and answer, so only the verbal or written response. And they do not rely on one moment in time answers. So it's really ongoing and observation based. So in 2017, you can see that 100 out of 102 districts or charter schools receiving voluntary pre-K funding elected to use the MDE-designed impact measure. The MDE impact measure plan and report is designed to help districts and charter schools understand the outcomes of VPK and School Readiness Plus, share the outcome information in a way that can inform district and charter schools' world's best workforce reports, and support program planning, professional development, and decision making. So you can see that when in the VPK requirement, there is a requirement that a teacher use a teacher interaction tool. And you can see how the voluntary pre-K programs reported which tools they are using. Charlotte Danielson is a common teacher evaluation tool used in the K-12 world, and they've recently adopted their tool to include early childhood educators. And then the class tool is most commonly used across Head Start programs and across many community-based child care programs. On the opposite side, you can see which of the KEP-approved assessment tools districts are using. And to no surprise, the TS Gold is the most widely used tool, followed by the work sampling system and the desired results developmental profile. So we are really focusing on those top three tools and hoping to increase our training in those areas.
Thank you, Ms. Burnham. Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, is it possible for you to provide us with a sample of at least one of these assessments?
Maybe so see how we rank?
We get a better understanding.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We also have a really nice video that shows the administration of the tools, and so we'll make sure you get both of those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Eric, thank you.
So this last slide is the application process for VPK is actually just closed. In statute, it states that applications must be submitted by January 30th, and so we are just cleaning up all those applications. We provide multiple opportunities for districts in technical assistance to ensure that their needs and questions are met through the application process, and respond to many, many questions around that application process. Because of the ongoing nature of the voluntary pre-K application with the School Readiness Plus application, so it's a lot of organizing by staff. The VPK and School Readiness Plus site allocation process, as you may know, the money is divided into these four buckets. Minneapolis and St. Paul receive 10%, Metro Suburban 40%, non-Metro 43%, and charter schools 7%, which equals the total allocation of $7,160. So this is a chart that just gives an indication of the number of applications that we've received over the last 2 years that were not funded. Since the money is capped, you can see that there was ample opportunity and desire for districts to have more voluntary or School Readiness Plus funding. In fiscal year 18, we had just over 9,000 requests for seats that went unfunded, and for fiscal year 19, just over 5,000 in requests that went unfunded. So moving on to scholarships, and like I mentioned earlier, I'm going to do the best I can with this. and channel Sandy as she's hopefully getting better. So the Early Learning Scholarship, which I mentioned earlier, is a funding source for high-quality programs. The purpose is to close the opportunity gap for low-income children through increased access to high-quality early learning childhood programs. Eligibility are children 3 years to kindergarten entrance from families with income equal to or less than 185% federal poverty guidelines. And the younger siblings attending the same program are eligible as well. Children birth to kindergarten entrance of teen parents pursuing a GED or high school diploma, children in foster care or in need of child protection services, and children in families experiencing homelessness. Those last four criteria areas serve as priority areas. You can see the number of children served has almost doubled since 2015, and the funding from fiscal years 16 through 19. So key program components for the Early Learning Scholarship Program is the scholarships are administered by area administrators. We have two pathways, which we'll get into in greater detail. Pathway one, scholarships are administered by area administrators. Four-star parent-aware rated programs eligible to apply to administer a designated number of scholarships based on their enrollment and wait list of scholarship eligible children are pathway two. So basically pathway twos go to eligible programs, and pathway ones, the money doesn't go to the families, but the pathway one scholarship follows the family, where a pathway two scholarship stays with the program. Scholarships may be awarded up to $7,500 for each eligible child per year to use at a parent-aware rated program. And children continue to receive a scholarship each year until they enter kindergarten. The outcome measure, increasing the number of at-risk children attending high-quality early childhood programs. And for scholarships, high quality is defined through parent-aware rating of 3 and 4 star. So we do have data that shows how many children have scholarships who attend a 3 and 4 star rated program. The monitoring of both pathways for scholarships includes application and eligibility review, review of invoices and payments, review fidelity of implementation of program policies, and results used for process improvement, guidance, and policy clarification. So the monitoring program not only provides added technical assistance to programs, but really helps us with our continuous improvement process of the scholarship applications.
Ms. Burnham, we have another question. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. On the slide where it's Early Learning Scholarships Program, on the very top it says scholarships administered by area administrators, pathway one. Can you tell me more about what that is?
Ms. Burnham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's a slide coming up that goes into greater detail on that.
Well, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. So the pathway one is awarded to eligible children through the area administrator, and pathway two is awarded to children through a 4-star rated parent-aware early childhood site. Children are awarded scholarships for a 12-month period from their start date. When a child is awarded a scholarship, he or she will continue to receive that until they enter kindergarten. Scholarships are awarded up to $7,500 for 12 months, and scholarships can be blended with other funds. So family income is equal to or less than 185% of the federal poverty level, or as demonstrated through families' participation in any of the following programs. So you can see the list of programs that automatically make a child eligible to receive a scholarship.
One moment, please. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, this is actually a follow-up from our earlier session. So you mentioned that scholarships can be blended with other funds and that there is that $7,500 limit. Can they be blended together? if a child qualifies for a pathway two scholarship privately, that they can move between different providers. Is it possible that behind the scenes, another provider or the area administrator is providing them with pathway one money too?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, so a child can only receive either a pathway one or a pathway two. So we have a early learning scholarship administrative system that is able to track those. So if you have a pathway one and you're attending one program and your family moves across town and you want to attend another program, that pathway one moves with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of along that same lines, too, but when it comes to pathway $2, since it's going to a program, the program itself a lot of times can leverage other dollars to serve more children, like community ed funding, school readiness funding. Is that accurate?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. In fact, we do a lot of technical assistance around how to support programs to blend and braid in order to increase access, increase, you know, number of hours, increase, make sure the professional development is occurring. So we do encourage the blending and braiding of funds.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to follow up on this because a lot of people worked on this, but one of the intents that I've seen in the past was to make sure that the day could be extended into after-school programs. That was one of the important things with these children, was making sure they just weren't cut off at 2:30 or 3, but we could blend it with programs that may take them into longer activities and give them more enrichment. So I just want to make sure I'm accurate on that, but I remember that was some of the intent.
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, that is accurate.
Very good. Thank you. Please continue.
So income verification for early learning scholarships includes, to qualify for an early learning scholarship, a family income must be equal or less to 185% of the poverty level. So 28% of families use option two to determine eligibility, compared to the vast majority of 72 under option one. So the early learning scholarship, let's see, expanded age eligibility and priority for 0 to 4 was implemented in July of 2018, as was the increase in the special or the priority populations as a percent of scholarships for 17 and 18. So serving those homeless children, the children in foster care, those high priority eligibility criteria went from 9% to 20%. So the outreach efforts really expanded and were more intentional to reach those most at-risk children. Children experiencing homelessness was the biggest growth, from 5% to 13% of all the awards, now representing 63% of all special population awards. And then coordination enhancements encouraged and supported. So we have a partnership with People Serving People, as well as county and tribal social services and alternative learning centers. And the exemption absent day data gathering new launch. Now, I'm not quite sure what that means, and I would have to get back to you on that. Number of absent days. Let's see. I think you can see the breakdown of those eligibility criteria and the number of kids served. This is getting to the regional administrators. So in Pathway 1, we have 10 non-governmental agencies, 2 tribal, and the regions align with the governor's economic development regions. So in each of these colored regions, we have contracted with local organizations to administer the Pathway 1 scholarships. So they are in charge of outreach and supporting families in the application process. Region 11, which is the metro region, is separated into the Hennepin, Ramsey, East Metro, Anoka, Washington, West Metro, Carver, Dakota, and Scott counties. Pathway 2 is not administered regionally. MDE directly funds school district, charter schools, Head Start organization, and there's one area administrator for the Child Care Pathway 2 program. So those community-based child care providers who receive Pathway 2 monies, we do have one area administrator, but the other Pathway 2 programs are administered through MDE. And this is a list, if you're interested, in the area administrators for Pathway 1. Oh, my gosh, and I think that's it.
Ms. Burnham, I apologize. I want to go back to this, and I've been bouncing around a number of responsibilities up here, so I may have missed it. What outcome measures do we get on the early learning scholarships?
So, Mr. Chair, we have a scholarship evaluation plan that we will provide to you that was done in 2016. If you are looking for individual child outcome measures, we have no way of collecting that at this point. So if you are interested in knowing if Susie had a scholarship and attended this Head Start or this community-based child care program or this school-based program, we do not, other than Head Start data, and if they attended a VPK program, we might have some impact data on that specific child. But other than that, we do not have the authority to collect data at this point that would give us an overall statewide child outcome impact measure.
So obviously we don't want to drill down to how Susie or Juanita or anybody else is doing individually, but we have no ability to assess whether the scholarship program is preparing students for kindergarten?
So the scholarship program increases access to high-quality programs. So the more access children have to high-quality programs, which we define as a 3- or 4-star rated program, that would be one impact measure of the scholarship program, is the number of children who attend those 3- and 4-star programs. We do not have any ability right now. Now, again, through the OLA report, one of the recommendations was to develop a way to assess children in certain early childhood programs, those being possibly parent-aware rated 3- and 4-star programs, as well as school readiness plus programs and VPK programs. So we are taking this year and taking the opportunity with this planning grant to figure that process out and figure out how to share, if we were to implement a statewide assessment system or impact measure system, what would it look like? And part of that is going to come from these community engagement opportunities that we're going to have through this preschool development grant needs assessment. Some of it, again, like I mentioned, is not in our authority to do. So it would take thinking through policies that would need to be revised or proposed. But again, we're going to take this year to do that thoughtfully.
Thank you. Representative Bennett, did I see correctly?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thanks for this very in-depth overview. It's been valuable. Just a question on your opinion, and I could be wrong on this information, but from what I understand, for the same amount of money it would cost to implement the voluntary pre-K throughout Minnesota for every 4-year-old, we could also, that same amount of money could fund the at-risk children all the way down to birth. So in your mind, is what is more effective in closing the educational gap? Would it be to do all 4-year-olds in Minnesota, or would it be to target those at-risk kids down to birth? Any thoughts on that, like this year?
Ms. Burnham, do you want to walk into that?
Mr. Chair, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? So I have lots of opinions. I think that it's going to take a balanced approach, and it's going to take an approach that looks at that learning continuum prenatal through grade three. It's not just about 0 to 3. There's a lot of work that needs to be done with the 0 to 3 population, as there is the 4-year-old population, as there is to ensure that elementary schools maintain that level of quality through kindergarten through third grade. So I think it's looking at the whole child, the whole family in each community. And so part of our work with the preschool development grant is really seeking information and conversations within each unique community to see what their needs are and to see what's going to turn the curve in their communities. So it could one strategy might be a priority in one community, and maybe a different strategy in another community. So that's what we're going to take the next year to find out.
Representative Bennett? Thank you. Any other questions for the presenters? Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, great conversation today. Thanks for setting up the day.
Thank you.
One of the things that, as I think through this and have conversations about this, and your balanced approach is a very accurate comment. And the reason I bring this up is we've had the discussions, or I've seen, we have this program sitting at MDH, and it's one thing to sit in the education committee and say, I'd like to have, you know, data. How are these kids going to be doing on certain educational, and those are very important, don't get me wrong. However, when we look at how this program has been focused, it is also solving other things that we need to get to, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, but and that is solving, you know, helping kids that are in a homeless situation, helping a student that's in a foster care, all these other layers that we have to peel back first just to get a student out of a trauma-induced situation to be able to academically perform. And so I, if I'm hearing you correctly, and part of the reason why we have this at MDH is solving those needs so that at some point we can get them to be academic. Would you say that's fair in the balanced approach that you brought that up?
Ms. Burnham?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I think, you know, regardless of what agency a certain program or initiative lives in, we all share the same priorities around reaching those most at-risk families and those most at-risk children, whether it be home visiting with MDH or you know, parent aware or voluntary pre-K. We all have to share the same responsibility for reaching those most at-risk kids. And I think that's one of the really positives of this preschool development grant we have, because it's really getting all of us to sit down at the same table with our colleagues at MMB, with our colleagues at Department of Administration, and really intentionally and thoughtfully designing and talking to communities about what their needs are. But our priorities, I'm sure we all share, is serving those most at-risk families in the most effective way.
Representative Christian.
And thank you. And a follow-up to that, and great comment there, because I think what I heard was, and I think that we've tried to do this very well, is it's let's not look at a program just as support or not support, but let's look at programs for the pros and cons and how they're reaching the child that we need to reach to. And so what you just said there, if I'm hearing that correctly, is multiple delivery systems to get to very complicated situations that we know exist. One of the things in the child protection is I found, and we find in education, those of us that have taught, no two families are the same. There is no two kids that are going through the exact same situation that I can apply a formula to say A plus B will get you to C. It's A plus quantum physics minus trauma minus the cosmos and gravity, and then maybe you're going to do well on your test.
Ms. Birnbaum?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And if you have time in a future hearing, you know, I could provide some greater detail about what the activities and outcomes we hope to gain from this preschool, this year-long opportunity we have to engage community, design a strategic plan, better build a mixed delivery system, and increase program quality. So I think that's really going to be key in we are definitely, when we wrote the preschool development grant application, we had the list of OLA recommendations right next to us, so we tried to embed every recommendation into the activities of that grant. So we're trying to meet those recommendations head on.
Well, Representative Kreischer, anything more?
All I would say to that is thank you, and to Mr. Chair, I'll put out, I think that would be a great place to start with some common ground. That's a something we could all be proud of and move forward on, and I would embrace that. So thank you for that comment.
You know, Representative Kreischer, I really appreciate your emphasis on kind of the whole child, that it's not just about test preparation, and that different kids are coming out of different situations. But I guess I'll roll this hand grenade out. We've spent, as a state, tens of millions of dollars out of this committee with the argument that the scholarship program would better prepare students for school. Mm-hmm. And yet we have no outcome measures as to whether that program is preparing anybody better for school, at which point it provokes the question, somewhat along the lines of Representative Bennett's question, should we recognize this, as you've argued to some extent, that this is a social service program to better hold and support children and families, all good, and not a program that prepares children specifically for kindergarten, and move it out of this committee's budget and move it entirely into Health and Human Services? Because if it's not preparing children for school, and we don't know whether it is because there are no outcome measures, maybe we should recognize that its strength is instead holding and supporting children and families and place it in a place where the expertise is deeper.
Yeah.
Representative Kreischer.
Thank you, and I'll continue the analogy. I think this is very good. I'll put the pin back in the hand grenade, and I'll offer it this way, because what you said I completely agree with and think that discussion should happen. One of the things that is a bit out of the purview of this committee but does affect us is what we're seeing with the Family First Act that has come from the federal government. And this is on the child protection side, but one of the things in our conversations with the feds and how they're going to implement this in DHS is they have identified graduation rates as one of their standards. It's the first time we've done that. And the reason that's important is because what we're seeing is we're stretching through the longitudinal and not just saying, can this kid survive kindergarten, but can this kid graduate? And so to your point, I think we're going to have to find a way for your programs, what you're doing, to intersect with DHS and get to those graduation rates. And so yes, and mm-hmm. is what I would offer. Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is maybe more of just a continuation of the conversation we're having, but please feel free to comment on it. I'm sorry to go down this rabbit trail, but as an educator, I am seeing continually how societal issues are landing in the laps of schools to solve. The teachers are supposed to solve it. The administrators are supposed to solve it. The schools are supposed to solve it. And it's bigger than the school. It's bigger than this finance division. But it's kind of, we're all talking around it. Maybe thoughts. I think a lot of our issues could be resolved if we could raise the CCAP rates. This is not within the purview of this committee, but if we address that issue, we wouldn't be talking about a lot of the things that we're talking about here. I think full-service community schools start to get at the wraparound services that our children need in our districts. I think all of these things can be considered a mixed delivery system, if you will, in supporting our kids. And I hope that, first of all, I appreciate the work that we're all trying to do here. But we're all trying to solve these really big problems under the microscope of education only and only with money. And I think we really have to broaden the way we're thinking about it and help our students through that approach.
And Representative Sandstead, I think you could throw things like paid parental and family leave into that same mix so that we give kids a strong start. Ms. Birnbaum, do you want to get into this?
Mr. Chair, and thank you. I agree with all of those things you listed, and just wanted to add the work that through education and through our partnership across agencies, and we are looking to really ramp up training around trauma-informed care. We are looking at how we can better support the mental health school grants. So we realize, again, it's all of our responsibilities. It's not agency specific because our kids cross all programs and in all communities. So I think it's really important that, you know, the full service community model is those wraparound services, but it's just not living in health and not living in human services or education. It's really all of us that are need to take responsibility for these services and in increasing the capacity of programs to better serve families.
Any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Oh, two things, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Ms. Burnham, Mr. Heller would like to ask you a question after the presentation, so if you would indulge him, I'd appreciate that. And my one last comment is, you know, we really need to get to the families, though, because we're not going to fix the children unless we can give parents tools to use. So we need to focus on that.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Ms. Birnbaum?
Mr. Chair, that's a great comment. And we know that, you know, by focusing on the whole child, that's very, very inclusive of the whole family and the community. And we, you know, have a great, what we're calling a two-gen policy and two-gen work across the agencies that, again, all agencies are involved in. So we really are focusing, and with our early childhood family education, we're really refocusing and making sure that these families who are most at risk get the services and supports they need.
Thank you, Ms. Birnbaum. Thank you, Ms. Snyder, for your presentation today. It obviously was very thought and question provoking, so thank you for that. Members, Ms. Burt has posted a meeting for Friday, February 22nd. It is a field hearing taking the work of this committee to the city of Windham for a hearing focused on education finance issues particular to our greater Minnesota schools. It will be a full and rich day, coffee and donuts on the bus provided by the chair. We leave at 7 a.m. We'll be returning at approximately 5:30 p.m. It will include a tour of the Windham Middle and High School, and the lunch is provided by the good people of the nutrition program there. So we'll be able to get a tour of the school. We'll be able to have lunch with students, and then we'll have a formal hearing of the committee. I do understand that this is can be a challenge. The only thing more difficult than holding a Friday meeting is holding a meeting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. Saturday or Sunday might be easier, but I'm not sure about that. So I would hope that members will attend, and I do appreciate your involvement. So there's a little heads up on future coming attractions. With that, any last questions? Hey, we got out of school early today. We stand adjourned. Thank you.